OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bald spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. The greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Okay, you're welcome along to this evening's football show. Very happy to say Pat Nevin is with us. Good evening. Good afternoon. Let's be honest, we're recording this earlier on today. They can see us in the bright light if they're watching. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, it's an interesting time. I've actually been from a morning run. And this afternoon, the garden needs some work done. So, you know, and it's a beautiful day here in Scotland. I don't know if you've got the same island, but it's gorgeous here. So, got to enjoy and love every moment of it. Like, you know, it's a better thing just now. Everyone feels so down about the coronavirus, and understandably so. But you kind of got to try to find the joy in there somewhere in life. You know, this is part of life. You've got to find the joy wherever it is inside it. That's not to ignore the troubles that people are having. It's just accepting the good bits you can get, grab them.
You ran 10K this morning.
Yeah, generally that's minimum I would run at the moment. So I do that each day now. I didn't used to do it. So I've lost something, 8.5 pounds since lockdown, because before that, you're traveling to games, you're eating stuff you shouldn't be eating, you're not getting all the exercise you should do. I've been let loose and I'm loving it now. Absolutely loving it now. So it's hill running. It's brilliant. And of course, I live in the countryside. So within 30 seconds, I'm in the hills. Love doing it. Which is, when you ask me every other week, yeah, can these footballers not get fit? And I'm going, actually, yeah, they should be. Because they should be out there running every day. You know, I'm ancient and I do it every day. So... I love it. But then I did talk to an old mate of mine, Brian McClure. I was talking to him on Zoom the other day there. And Brian, he started getting out running. And that was the biggest shock I've had this year. Because he hates running. Some people just hate it. It doesn't matter if you're a sportsman or whatever. Some people just hate running. But at the moment, in these times, you kind of got to do it if you can.
Deep down, if I'm being honest, I hate it. Yeah. No, it's just not built for it. I can just even tell by your general physique, you're built for it, you're made for it. For me, it's a means to an end, and the end is the joy when you get back out of the shower. That 2-3 hours, the rest of the day almost, I mean, just physiologically, mentally, whatever other way you want to mention, the difference it makes. So for me, each step is felt and it, you know, and endured almost. And I've never quite been able to get to a point where I love it and I love the process of it.
Actually, you know, anyone who's not into it and doesn't love running, right? See those of us who love it, right? It's not easy. It's really, honestly, it's not easy. We feel the pain too. It's absolutely the case. Like, when I was younger, I would ping along and I could run for 2 hours, pinging along, and felt nothing. Absolutely nothing. I just ping along and it was like a walk. You know, but that's not the case the older you get. So, yes, there's a pain there, but you can enjoy the fact that you are working hard. So don't look at people and go, I'm finding this terrible. This isn't getting any easier. I'm still hurting. Yes, it hurts. Don't worry. Everyone's the same. All humans are like this, unless you're very young and incredibly fit. So don't get downcast about that. And the big thing is about running, especially any sort of distance at all, is every single time you do it, it's timing, it's good. Because you will notice you're 30 seconds better after the third one and 30 seconds more. It feels as if you're not recovering, you're not getting better, but you are getting better. You might take 5 stops in your first run. You might only take 4 in the second one. You need to check it a few months on and you'll see how different it is.
The technology has really made it a more enjoyable thing to do. Even somebody I was talking to who is not a runner and in the current climate, she is starting, and she was able to download this app, couch Starver. To 5K. And, you know, initially it's really nice, you know, so she tells me what to do. I have to run for 3 minutes, then I stop and walk for a minute, then I run a bit more. And obviously over the course of a few weeks, she'll get to run the 5K in totality. But I thought that's a lovely way to do it, to almost hand over the reins to somebody else.
And it's great. I use Strava. And Strava's, you know, it just tells you the distance you've gone, the height, you know, your average, you know, speed that you're going, all that sort of stuff. Now, to be honest, professional athletes are all doing that as well. You know, they're told exactly what to do. They're having to time it. But if you put it on, I mentioned Strava, it happens to be the one that I use, but there are others out there. You kind of hide it. You just need to press a button, email it in, and you can't say, oh, no, no, I did that much, much quicker. I think...
Ross Barkley may have hit pause once or twice in the midst of his run. I think you just 3 or 4 minutes off the world record, Ross. Who knew he was such a box-to-box midfielder?
Yeah, I'll show you. To be honest, everybody, the amount of people that do it, even in pro sport, they try and, during training, try and cheat a little bit. And they always get the same phrase. I mean, everyone say it together. You're only cheating yourself.
Well, indeed.
And it is so true. Absolutely so true.
A link with all the running. Today marks the anniversary, not a particularly profound one or anything, but of Roger Bannister in 1954, the 4 minute mile, 3 minutes, 59 seconds, 0.4. Mm-hmm. And this was always held up as an example of the power of belief, the Bannister 4 minute mile, in that he beat, you know, he cracks it first. And there was a sense of, well, others followed very quickly because, you know, there were even rumors you would combust instantly as a human being, crack the 4 minute mile. And I think within a year, they were up to 4 or 5 who'd broken it. And the year after that, you know, 30 or something had broken it. Still not that many have in history, like 1,400, I think, is the total. But it was always held up as this is an example of the power of the mind. And I never quite bought that with Bannister. I just thought natural progression and training meant that it was going to be broken sooner or later and all the others would have followed either way. Now, not exactly.
He didn't think that way, by the way. He thought none of that.
Did he? Yeah.
He was a doctor. He was an intelligent man.
And he got all that.
Brilliant career afterwards. So he never thought any of that nonsense.
Yes, and it's not exactly lab conditions. But the reason I bring it up, and there is something in it though, because even you can think of numerous examples. Like, for instance, there was a 10-year period here where a glut of Irish golfers won majors. And they all said, you know, Harrington made the breakthrough. And then they all said, oh, well, I kind of, you know, I know him. It demystified it a little bit. I've seen him make mistakes. I've seen him at his worst. And, you know, McDowell won one and Clark won one. And, well, McIlroy would have regardless, I presume. But the power of belief, is that something that you thought about much as a player? Did you believe in it? You know, the power of the mind, all that kind of stuff, inhibiting beliefs?
I kind of understood it. I always understood it. I'd studied psychology anyway. It's one of the sort of things that I'd studied before I became a footballer. So I understood it anyway. And So I've been brought up within the Celtic tradition. I'd been Celtic as a kid, which had this attitude of, oh, there is only one thing, winning. You know the rest. It's all dull, that's first and worst, all that sort of stuff. And you're really indoctrinated, and it was like Jesuitical, all that sort of stuff. You really were indoctrinated with it. So you kind of had it. But you noticed that other people didn't have it. And I mean professionals didn't have that. And you'd look at them and go, why don't you feel that way? Why don't you understand this concept? That there are only these two positions, and they would kind of just do their best. But no, you will not be able to win. But it gets much easier to win when you know you can. It really is. It's the amount of teams that I've talked to. My classic example, I'd give you from my career, I played for Chelsea for 5 years, and every year we'd go and try and win the FA Cup and hope that we might. And then I went to Everton, who thought, yeah, we should win the world with the FA Cup this year. He said, that's different. One group of players weren't that much better than another group, but that group said, yeah, we should win this. Now, Everton got to the FA Cup final that first season and thought, yeah, that's where we should be. Had it been with that other group of players, it'd been, wow, we're here, this is amazing. And it's a totally different mindset. And it's a kind of lucky to be here kind of thing. In a very, very simplistic way, if you actually think you're going to do it, the chances are you've got a much, much better chance of doing it. And that's the most simplistic way of putting it, but that's at the root of it all. Mm. And the amount of people that I've worked with that I've looked around me. I mean, another great example, again, it's at that level, and it's at that level. It's right up there and right, I'm trying to see the camera, right up there. Up there and down there. And I remember going, I put Kilmarnock near the end of my career. I remember a few weeks into my, I thought, not a bad team this, actually. These lads are good. You know, they really believe in themselves. I know about 10 or 11 games in, we go to play Celtic at Celtic Park. Get out, right, we're right. We're ready, lads. Turn around. Silence. Scared to death. And I'm going, you were all right. 10 minutes ago, you lot. And just that, and they were beaten before they walked out. They were gone before they walked out. And it's like another cliche, but it's absolutely utterly true. And I'm walking around going, they're only blokes of these guys. Yeah, they're quite good, but we need to fight them. If you think you're not good enough. And so many of them went into their shells in front of Parkhead and all those supporters. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The first time, and then when you beat them once, you think, oh, that's how you do it. But you need to do it that first time. And that's harder when you've got the wrong psychology.
I was going to add, well, I guess you sort of answered the next question because I was going to ask, well, let's ask it then, aside from winning and getting that victory and seeing for yourself that it's possible, is there anything a manager can say or do to almost imbue a team with certain belief in themselves?
I've seen a million different ways of doing it. You know, some have tried, humour is a cracker, actually. It really is quite a good one because it relaxes everyone. You think, oh, well, just have a go. You mean it? The shouting and bawling and the fist pumping stuff, very good. Everyone does that. Yeah, that's going to work maybe once if you're lucky.
Yeah.
But you've got to think a wee bit better than that. You've got to get slightly inside the minds of the most important players. You need to make sure that the leaders are still leading and they're not hiding in a corner as well. You need to make sure when they walk out there, when you're on the ball, you're not seeing a whole big bunch of backsides in front of you, people that don't want to get a ball. You need all those different things. But odd enough, humour is, I found that quite a fun one and a good one. I remember Tam Burns used to play for Celtic in Scotland. He came away with an absolute cracker once. And the Kelly boys told me about it, and he was the Kelly manager at the time, and they were playing against Celtic, and he knew that they had the psychological problem. And he gave them the big talk, and he said, right, lads, completely, I'll be there, I'll be at your backs, and you know, you'll know where I am all the way through this. You can turn around, you'll know where I am. And the lads go, yeah. And he jumped into the basket where they kept the strips and clothes. Sat in there. I'm not coming out. You lot are going to get hammered. And he was like winding them up. And they just all started laughing at him. And they went out and they got a result on the day. Apparently it was a draw or something like that. So you know, lighten it. Make sure that you're not going to tense. That's a good thing as well. But for some guys that'll work, for some guys it won't. So you need to know what is the best thing to work for each individual. And the worst thing is most managers of a certain ilk think there is one way, or they try the one way with everyone. Well, that's not the case because we're all different psychologically. You should be going around, you need that, you need that, you need nothing, you need that, you need that. And you should know those people. And that's how you get better. But I mean, it is that psychological thing, that great moment when you think, we can do this. And suddenly it gets easier.
Yeah. You strike me as a player who would have been maybe at best indifferent to the hairdryer treatment, if not slightly dismayed by the thought of it, especially a regular one.
Well, oddly enough, I was writing about it recently. I got hammered really, when I was about 15, 16, and this manager who shouted and bawled and screamed and gave me the hole right up in the face, spit in the face, everything. And I got it every single week for a year. I played a year, I was top goal scorer, all that. Every single week I got it. During the games and at halftime and after the game, I get shouting and screaming and bawling. And he was about 6 foot one, this guy. I was like, I'm not enjoying this anymore, so I'm not going to play anymore. He just said at the end of the season, it's a long story, the shortened version is, he just said, I don't only shout at good players, you know, because there's no point shouting at bad players. And by the way, that was a test you passed. And no one will ever have an effect on you. And a couple of managers tried to, during my career, shouting, bawling, screaming right there. And I was like, bothered. It had no effect. Because I knew within myself what I needed to do. But I've watched other people be crushed by it. I've watched other people be lifted by it. I have to tell you, in the scheme of things, more get crushed by it than are lifted by it. Many, many more. Now, in the old school in the game, they would say to you, well, they weren't strong enough personalities anyway, so that they were going to fold. And maybe I was on their camp in that, you know, my early days. As time has gone on, you realise, people come on at different times. They are personalities. You just have to find the best way to get the best out of them. But I've seen people crushed, and it's horrible. to see it, like people who could have had decent careers just ruined by that old school thinking.
Yes. And it, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I don't know, did I say this to you a while back? It was in Wayne Rooney's article in the Sunday Times. Alex Ferguson, who you wouldn't say was totally progressive when it came to that whole area, but Rooney was making the point, your face told a picture there. Rooney was making the point that he did pick and choose a little bit. So Rooney felt if, for instance, Ronaldo was giving the ball away too much, then Rooney always got it for giving the ball away too much. Or the other one he always picked on was Giggs. So if Nani was dribbling too much, then Giggs got given it at halftime for dribbling too much. And Ronaldo and Nani would be sitting beside Giggs and Rooney and noticing all this. Now, the downside was Giggs and Rooney had to take this for, well, in Giggs's case, 20-odd years. But at least that showed on Ferguson's part, because, you know, he obviously so successful, had to have many strings to his bow. A certain understanding, probably instinctive as opposed to read in books or picked up, but a certain understanding of various personality types.
I know where he got it from. I know where he stole it.
Jock Steen?
Yeah. And it's, and I remember Benny explained to me, Danny McGrain explained it to me one day. And he explained what Jock used to do, because he used to want to hammer certain players. But he'd say, they can't take it, so I'm going to hammer you. And he'd tell you beforehand. And you're getting battered. But it's not aimed at you, it's aimed at him who's over there. Who's thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get that next.
Yeah.
He's the one that's going, is getting it, really, who's going to get it. He did once, apparently, another one he did with Dalglish, where he told Davy Hay and he told Danny McGrain, he just said, by the way, I'm going to hammer Dalglish today. I'm going to absolutely batter him today. It doesn't matter what he does. Apparently, he scores a hat trick. The minute he hammered him anyway. Absolutely went through him.
Right.
He's done a couple of things that have not, he's, in simplest terms, get a bit big for his boots in the moment. In the moment, and Steen had to drag him back. So he considered, so it looks like loss of control. I think that's the point you're making about Ferguson. It looks like lack of control and loss of control. When in actual fact, it's not really all the time. There are people that are a lot cleverer than that. And you're right, they will pick and choose the ones. And the worst one, I'd say, I'm sure I've told you before, I get the worst. I didn't get the head drive from Sir Alec. I got worse than that from him.
Ignored.
No, I get silence. I did the wrong thing playing for Scotland against England. And instead of shouting and bawling me, asked me the question, I gave the wrong answer. And he went, he just walked away. I don't think that's going very well. So I didn't get picked for going to the World Cup in 86. Under Sir Alec. I didn't do the right thing at that point in time. That was just before the World Cup as well. I was kind of on trial with him. But I was, you know, you actually knew that was worse than a hairdryer, just to get the old.
And do you remember what he asked you? Was it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, clearly, yeah. I was playing. We were 2-1 down. I was in a box with Terry Butcher. I dummied him two ways, went round him. Butch took me out. I didn't go down. Held my feet, laid the ball back. Roy Aitken smashed it over the bar. After a game, we could beat 2-1 at Wembley. And Sir Alec came over and said, did Butcher catch you in the box? I went, yeah, he did, but I've got decent balance. I managed to hold myself up and not go down. and he just went, and walked away. As if to say, didn't say anything, didn't need to say anything, but I didn't go to Mexico.
Particularly cutthroat.
That was a real kind of moment of, there you go.
Could you tell in that very brief time you might have had with him around then that he was going to be so special?
He already was. In our eyes, in Scottish people's eyes, he was, because of what he'd done with Aberdeen. Because Celtic and Rangers had been such, you know, such a stranglehold on it, yet there he goes to Aberdeen and manages to put this. You remember, they won a European trophy. It was Aberdeen.
Beat Real Madrid, didn't they, in the final?
Real Madrid. It's not when Real Madrid were rubbish. It was Real Madrid. And they had put a lot of good teams on the way there as well. So to do it in a European and realising it's not a one-off because he's beaten Celtic and Rangers in the league, that's pretty spectacularly good. So I think the thinking was at the time he was really highly rated. Whether you thought he would go and do what he did, no. I don't think anyone could have guessed that. That's massive. That's gigantic. That's over and above any expectation. And by the way, just to go back to Sir Alec, remember asking McClare about that. I said, how many times has the gaffer gave you, ran through you, gave you the whole lot? He goes, he tried it once. Never bothered again. Because Brian's so inscrutable, so kind of, aye, right, okay, very good. And he is completely, you cannot read McClure. Mm. And but funnily enough, Sir Alex, he was always, Brian was always called Sir Alex Boy, as in his son. And he just, but Sir Alex couldn't read Brian. He could read most people, but he could never read Brian. Mm. And he couldn't understand why Brian would take the complete piss out of him and think it was okay and always play tricks on him. Like Brian used to take him in, I don't know if you know this, like Brian used to take him into training every day because he lived nearby, just around the corner. But he'd leave his phone down and Brian would always change the phone because Brian's good with technology. And every time his phone would ring, he would say, Chalky is great, in Sir Alec Ferguson's phone. And he would change the tunes to weird music that Brian and I would like. And like, he'd no idea how to change it back and, you know, just simple things like that. And he knew it was Brian was doing it and Brian would just sit there laughing.
I didn't think he was a man you played tricks on like that. There you go.
He isn't. Because he can read most people, he just couldn't read Brian.
Brian is unreadable, though, isn't he? I mean, I've only come to realize this quite late about Brian McClure. We're all unique, but he's definitely unique.
Of all the people, there's two people in my career I ever played with, made me feel like a normal footballer. Brian was one of them, and Neville Southall was the other one. I was closer to a normal footballer than they were. I see Brian quite a lot, not at the moment, obviously, but we get in touch through Zoom, and he's the same. But he has a wee trick to play if any ever meet up with Brian, which you will in Ireland because he goes over to the Man United supporters clubs around the world. Brian's kind of like that. He's really good with it, the way he does it, helpful in the way he does it. Get him drunk, and then you see the real Brian. There's the clue.
One last Ferguson question. His general demeanour away from, you know, hairdryer and not hairdryer, those very memorable moments, just as a general presence around the place, how would you describe it?
It's away from the ground. It's a lot. Funnily enough, I was talking about this last night to, of all people, Kelly Gates, Kenny's daughter. And it was really interesting to ask her. Like, somebody said to us, well, what's it like, you know, when, you know, you have to be a different man in front of the press. And she asked that question to me, and I went, what are you asking me for? You know better than anybody. You watch your dad. Mm. Who everybody thought was a dull, annoying, all the journalists couldn't cope with Kenny at all. But I knew Kenny because I played with him. He's a right laugh. He's just, he's so funny. He's very dry, but he's very, very funny as well. He's always looking for a laugh with people. And he's an intelligent enough guy as well. And people have to be a different person in different situations. You're not the same talking to me. I know you're in your house, but when you go in and talk to your wife, you'll be a wee bit different to the way you're talking to us, you know, just now. We are different people in different situations. It's basic psychology stuff. Mm. And absolutely, the managers are all the same. They are totally different. Kelly was saying last night, well, she was interviewing David Moyes. He was in his home in Zoom. Totally different person. Absolutely different. You know, totally relaxed. Mm. You know, the stress isn't on. Okay, we're not in a stressful situation at work just now, but put them in different circumstances and you're seeing a completely different thing. Kenny was a classic example of that. And Sir Alex is exactly the same. He really was exactly the same. But it was always away from the football grounds. That was the difference. Meet him at a football ground if he's the manager when he's at Scotland, or he's the manager of Man United when I'm playing against Manchester United. It's very businesslike, very strong. You're not getting anything more. You're just getting the dead eyes and the business stuff, right? I remember him once coming around to the training ground when it was about 2 or 3 years into it. And for whatever reason, he was there. And he sat down where I was sitting in the canteen place. And honestly, he dropped into that calm conversation you'd have with a friend from Glasgow. Now, we are both from rough areas of Glasgow. And it was that conversation. We'd never had that conversation before. We'd never had that relaxed. But we were right in there within a sentence. So take him out of the environment and the other person's allowed to come back. And Sarah, he was great. interesting, enjoyable, very, very, very political. I mean, stunningly political. I mean, very hard left at that time, but certainly very much for you. He would talk to me to death about unions and what the union were doing, what we should be doing, and how he could help, that sort of thing. So take them out of the environment, and yeah, they are different.
That's a great answer. To round this off, there's not much news to talk about, but to bring people up to date who are only casually dipping into Project Restart, as we have to call it now. What's happened of late is that the Aston Villa chief executive, Christian Perslow, has been talking. The plan as it stands is neutral venues. And so Perslow has come out and said, well, look, 17 of our 25 points have come at home. We're second from bottom. We've a game in hand on Watford. He said, personally, talking about neutral venues, I'm against it. We're a club that prides itself on home form. Two-thirds of our wins this season have come at home. We've got six home games left. And I think any Villa fan would agree that giving up that advantage is a massive decision for somebody running Aston Villa. And I certainly wouldn't agree to that unless those circumstances are right. Following that, the League Managers Association chief, Richard Bevan, he was saying that, well, if this isn't passed, if this neutral venue plan isn't passed, he said, yes, I think the season probably will be cancelled. Now, they need 14 of 20. They'll probably get 14 of 20. I don't know how messy all this gets if the other six are really, you know, really unhappy about this. And maybe they can, you know, wink and a nod, and certain players say, oh, I don't really want to play in the current circumstances. Like, they can get this thing stopped if they really want to. But that's where we are. I don't know what's jumping out at you over the last couple of days.
I'm amazed. I mean, first of all, that's no different from my position of 7 weeks ago. Richard Bevan just saying just now, I can't imagine you do it in all the grounds. I just can't imagine the logistics. The logistics are hard enough as it is. You take the logistics of everyone has to play their home games at the home grounds, and it's mind-blowing. That travel, that amount of games, in that short of time, it's almost unthinkable. Almost all the ideas that you have to go down the route of now are unthinkable. What you have to do in these situations is find a method, the simplest method, a core way where the logistics can be made as easy as possible. And I thought there would be one or two that would say, oh, we need the home games, but would basically crack really quickly because they realised it was not possible. But it sounded a wee bit loud. I think Brighton may have made some noises about it.
Brighton and Villa publicly have come out very strongly. Yeah.
Now, fine, you're fighting for your case. You need to fight for your case. But I think, I suspect when they look at the reality, they'll say, actually, that's doable. And it may well be that their game plan, their end game is, remember, it's kind of game theory stuff. Like, they're saying, right, okay, what's the game if we game it this way and then the games don't go ahead? Well, do we stay up? Do we go down? Do they null and void the season? Do they average points? Do you know, they will take all that into consideration. Just sadly, it's the way of business. I just don't think it's going to happen like that. I think what they do is they will bend and accept that they will have to play at neutral venues. It may be a number of neutral venues, and they will find that way of getting by. But however, that's not to say it's going to happen. I mean, underlying, that's not to say it's going to happen. There's a million things that can stop it happening before that gets there. But to add, you know, complexities and, you know, more difficulties into what has to be a streamlined, simple way, you're just ruining the chances of you finishing it. I don't know if you heard, they made a big thing about yesterday in the UK. Gordon Taylor had mentioned the fact that, you know, maybe five subs and the possibility of playing shorter games. Place went mad. Gordon wasn't saying play shorter games. He was just saying there is a problem. One of the problems is with a 4 week run up, players won't be fit to play 90 minute games three times a week. That's what the medics say. Okay, so you look at the problem from the other angle and say, well, shorten the games and they can play that. It's just an idea. A number of people have come up with it. They're all hammering Gordon Taylor now. What are you saying? How dare you? He wasn't saying that. He was saying, but this is what you take every set of circumstances and you balance them with that one. We are in weird country now.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about five substitutes. Somebody at some point, I don't think I've said it yet, right? I've not said it yet. Trust me, it will happen in the next few weeks. Someone will say the phrase rolling substitutes, right?
Yeah.
It's a set. So there's nothing surer in the world that somebody will say something about rolling substitutes, right? I've not heard it yet. But it's just complete and utter logic.
Yeah.
It's utter logic. And in situations, you need to take these things on board.
Yeah, and in fairness to Taylor, actually, he said that the 45-minute halves had been discussed. He didn't say he thought this was a great idea. It was just in passing in a Radio 4 interview. He said that it was discussed at the meeting. He didn't massively
That's not how it was promoted in Vegas.
No. Taylor insists on 45-minute halves. Must go. I mean, if you're Perslow, if you're Aston Villa, because he used the figure 200 million to finish up on this point, he said, you get relegated potentially. If you don't bounce back straight away, you're looking at 200 million gap. He may figure, you know what, TV money, whatever is still owing to us, if we can get this thing null and voided and we're guaranteed in the Premier League next year, well, I'm game theory in my way to that solution one way or another. And he just needs the other five or six who are also looking over their shoulders at relegation to come along with him.
Yeah, but he also has to put it in his mind that almost a lot of other leagues have looked at that concept and said, no, just take it as average points now. You're going down. And which, again, because if you see it null and void, the teams from below, they're going to sue you. They are going to sue. And they'll probably win.
Will they probably win? If you null and void the Championship and you null and void the Premier League, would they be doing that?
You've entered an agreement. It's a contract with all the different organisations. Mm. And you've spent a lot of money. And you've got yourself, like, say, you're Leeds United or whatever. Mm. So you have taken a chance and taken a risk. But the risk is just about to pay off. And then they change the rules. And you think, well, you can't change the rules.
I'm not an expert. I just would have thought force majeure comes in and you get away with anything.
Possibly, but possibly not. You know, because they could say, yeah, but that's because they played the game. That's because Aston Villa said this and Brighton said that.
Yeah.
And they manipulated it. You know, if other leagues, say the German league, managed to finish their league, they'll just turn around and go, what about them? Who did it? So, hey, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Nobody knows the answer to that. That's why the law, and that's what makes lawyers very, very happy.
Yeah.
None of us know the answer to that. That's the big smiles come up in the lawyers' faces.
Sure does.
That will be extraordinary. That will go legal. That's not a maybe. That's a definite.
Well, on that note, we will say goodbye for this week. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks a million. Pat and Evan, great as always.
Pleasure. Speak to you soon.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.